Good morning, everybody. It is a pleasure to be here. Oh, yes. Okay, let's do it again. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Excellent. You surprised me. Thank you. 7 years ago, I startled one of my closest friends by announcing to her that I was going to leave Wall Street. "Are you sure you know what you're doing?" she asked. This was her polite, euphemistic way of wondering if I'd lost my mind, because I was at the top of my game. I had just gone to Mexico for an investor day with America Mobile, one of the largest cellular companies in the world. As I sat in the audience with hundreds of others, Carlos Slim, the controlling shareholder and one of the richest men in the world, quoted my research report and referred to me as La Whitney. Meanwhile, I had institutional investors such as Fidelity asking for my financial models, and when I upgraded or downgraded a stock, it would move several percentage points. It was with good reason that my friend questioned my sanity, especially because she knew that getting to this place of power and respect was hard won. 20 years ago, my husband and I went to New York so he could pursue his PhD at Columbia. We were in New York, so I wanted to work on Wall Street. But as a music major, I had never set foot in an accounting, finance, or economics course. So I started as a secretary. That's actually earlier than the late 80s, but just to show how antiquated the whole notion can be at times. Anyway, with a lot of hard work and a little luck, I was eventually able to move up the food chain into investment banker. I then took a step back to become an equity research analyst. 8 years later, having risen to become a number one analyst, I took another step back by quitting my job and planning to produce a reality TV show about soccer in Latin America and publish a children's book, neither of which happened. Instead, I ended up blogging about work-life issues and starting a fund with Harvard's Clayton Christensen. My career path has been unusual, but perhaps that's the new normal. In the U.S., median job tenure since 1983 has actually been 5 years. Baby boomers have held 11 jobs on average, and the percentages of people that stay at a job longer than 10 and 20 years have declined substantially. It's more difficult to document a career change because it's harder to define a job switch, but there is increasing evidence that it's more common, and case studies abound. It may be difficult to make sense of these seemingly wanton but ultimately satisfying career moves until you consider the theory of disruptive innovation. For those of you unfamiliar with this terminology, disruptive innovation is a term coined by Clayton Christensen to describe a low-end or new market innovation that eventually upends an industry. A disruptor, think the Japanese, Korean automakers, secure a foothold at the low end of the market, and then in the pursuit of profit, gradually produce higher performance, higher margin products. The established competitors, like the U.S. auto manufacturers, could aggressively counter an attack by the low-end disruptors, but they don't because it doesn't make financial sense to defend their least profitable products. Until, of course, it does make sense, and then it's too late. There are volumes of research indicating that the odds of success improve for companies, even countries, when we pursue a disruptive course. I believe that harnessing this powerful mindset of disruption begins with the individual. Companies don't disrupt, people do. That doesn't mean that everybody needs to abandon their traditional path. If you're pursuing an ambitious goal like the C-suite, then stay the course. No disruption is necessary. But if you've reached a plateau and suspect that you won't be happy at the top rung of your current ladder, then you may need to disrupt yourself for the same reason that a company must. Sometimes it's because you need to head off the competition. What you do well, perhaps even brilliantly so, will eventually be done by a cheaper, more nimble version of you. When it comes to personal disruption, more importantly, compensation isn't just financial. Psychological and social factors also matter. Elizabeth Keeler is a self-decreed vocational cliff jumper. Her resume includes businesswoman, pianist, chemist, and dancer, and she's only 30 years old. She used to feel terribly embarrassed by the fact that she couldn't follow just one path, as if this made her fickle or weak. But she's come to understand that disrupting herself on a regular basis is actually a necessary remedy to stagnation. You may be thinking, I want to disrupt myself. I want the rewards that personal disruption might bring, but I have no idea what my dream is. What would I disrupt myself for? When I left Wall Street in 2005, in part, my motivation was my children. They were 9 and 5, respectively. I wanted to focus more on the art of mothering and be more a part of their growing up. Now that I was no longer working 80-plus hours a week, I had some time to talk to the mothers of my children's friends. These were bright, interesting, intelligent women, and I found myself asking them, "What's your dream?" I was surprised when I heard all too often, "I don't have a dream," or "I don't know how to do my dream." And frequently there was an unspoken, "I'm not sure it's my privilege to dream." This concerned and saddened me. These were supremely capable women, and I wanted them to see the possibilities for themselves that I saw. I knew I had to do something. I had to build a case for dreaming. I thought about writing a book, but no agent would have paid me any mind, so I took the disruptive approach, and I started at the low end, securing a foothold in publishing via a blog. My blog became a forum where women could share the stories of their dreams and to try to answer that elusive question, what is my dream? Many of us had something that we longed to create or achieve when we were young, but as we've grown up, we've pushed that away in favor of more pressing needs. So one of the first questions I ask women, and I ask you today, is what did you love to do as a child? Athelia Woolley, for example, loved fashion, but she couldn't sew. She couldn't actually learn how to sew very well, so she set that dream aside until she graduated with her master's in social work and became sick enough she couldn't hold a 9-to-5 job, nor could she work and travel abroad, which were her other dreams. As she took stock of what she could do, she found herself going back to her childhood love of fashion and considering the prospect of starting an online retailer. That was 2005. Today, Shabby Apple is on track to generate more than $1 million in revenue. Louise Driscoll said, "Within your heart, keep one still secret spot where your dreams may go." I don't know what your dream is, but what I do know is that it is your privilege to dream. It is also your privilege to do your very own dream. I also know that only dreamers can disrupt. And whether at an organizational or individual level, we all seem to follow 4 basic rules. For your consideration, rule number 1. Target a need that can be met more effectively. Customers don't actually buy products, they hire them to fulfill a need. So disruptors look for needs that aren't being met well in markets where no one wants to play or no one has thought of playing. Back to my building a case for dreaming, I had a need to publish what I'd written. That need couldn't be met by a high-end book publisher, but it could be met by a low-end blogging platform. A great example of a fulfillment of an unmet need is that of Meredith Perry. As an undergrad at Penn, she went to class one day with a dead laptop and no power cord. Shouldn't you be able to charge wireless devices wirelessly, she thought. Perry, a former NASA intern, set out to solve the problem. She started looking on Google and Wikipedia. She pulled together this information, and by pulling that together, she built a working prototype of a transmitter that could use ultrasonic waves in order to recharge the wireless devices. Today, or actually this summer, Perry received $750,000 in funding for her company, Ubeam. Rule number 2, identify your disruptive strengths. Disruptors don't just look for unmet needs, they also look to leverage their distinctive strengths as well as to try something new rather than competing against established rivals. For example, America Mobile that I mentioned earlier, rather than skirmishing with Telmex For the 20 million people that could afford a landline, they went after the 80 million people that couldn't, with more affordable access to phones via cellular technology. Adam Richardson was working as an industrial designer at Sun Microsystems in the 90s when he discovered that very few engineers could design to customer needs. Adam wasn't the strongest stylist, but he was enthralled by market research and good at capturing it. His path ended up veering. He studied sociology, cultural anthropology, cultural theory, and now those disciplines form the bedrock of his work that combines design with customer insights. When you're disrupting yourself, don't just look at what you do well, but what you do well that others don't. Rule number three, step back or sideways in order to grow. When organizations get too big, they often stop exploring smaller opportunities because the resulting revenue won't impact their bottom line enough. Just as Borders was slow to embrace e-commerce, and we know what happened to Borders, people could actually stall at the top of their personal learning curve. We avoid that by jumping to a new curve. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to change companies. Dave Blakely, he started as an engineer at IDEO 20 years ago. He could have worked his way up to manage technical staff, but instead he volunteered to become a project manager, which many of his peers dismissed as an escape route from the rigor and detail of engineering. But by taking this step back, Blakely broadened his skills, began to climb another ladder, and today he's the head of technology strategy at IDEO. Heather Coughlin gave up an equity sales VP slot at Goldman Sachs in order to help launch Hudson Street, an independent research firm. Coughlin got in on the ground floor not only because she thought demand for research would grow, but because she thought her need for personal growth could be met more effectively in a startup environment. Many thought it ill-advised to leave her comfortable perch, but the operating skills that she acquired are what propelled her into a biz dev role and ultimately the CEO seat at ISIS Parenting, an education company for parents of newborns. If you're concerned about plateauing, take a step sideways or backwards, it may turn into a slingshot. A heart-wrenching but ultimately uplifting story is that of photographer Lenola Kathleen Stone. After years of waiting to find the right man, she married only to find that he was emotionally and physically abusive. As she stayed in the marriage, the images in her mind and heart that she'd always relied on as part of her gift for photography vanished. It was frightening to consider taking a step back of leaving the marriage, but as she said no to abuse, the images began to reappear. Lenola recently had a dream fulfilled of publishing her first book. Rule number four, let your strategy emerge. As a dreamer and disruptor, you are in search of a yet-to-be-defined market. You can't know the opportunity at the outset. This requires an emergent strategy. Rather than performing detailed market analysis, developing a step-by-step plan to achieve your goal, you take one step forward, you gather feedback, adapt accordingly. This will likely mean that you'll end up in a place very different than what you had initially anticipated, but you won't be alone. The research indicates that for 70% of all successful new businesses, the strategy they end up with is different than the one they initially pursued. Like Netflix, it started out as a door to, although sometimes we don't know if we think they're successful anymore, but at one point we did. They started out as a door-to-door DVD retail service and then have morphed into a streaming company. A personal example of emergent strategy is that of Sabina Nawaz. As a young computer engineer at Microsoft, she was climbing quickly up the ranks, probably positioning herself for a coveted VP role when she received positive feedback about her management skills, and she asked to move into a human resources role, which was very much disrupting herself, and she stayed there for 7 years. Then, rather than continuing to climb at Microsoft, Sabina left to start her own leadership development consultancy. This had never been her plan, but she let her strategy emerge. As a girl, Jean Knight The world was wide open. She could be anything she wanted, doctor, lawyer, singer, writer, except she couldn't be a homemaker because learning to cook, sew, and rear children or care for children was out of vogue. So when she fell in love, got married, had a baby, not only loved the baby, she liked him, it surprised her just a little. It surprised her even more when she discovered that she wanted to learn how to cook. She started with hamburger helper, graduated to mashed potatoes, and now she makes everything from scratch. Her interest in food combined with a tight budget led her to start a blog called The Tasty Cheapskate. She never really intended to become a mother, a skilled cook, an expert at the art of budgeting. But as her life unfolded, her dreams shifted. And then Jean did what all disruptors must do. She let her strategy emerge. We all like to make plans for the future. In fact, it's important that we make plans for the future. But pursuing a disruptive course requires a willingness to pivot and to not see the end from the beginning. Nor can we rely on the predictability of simple cause and effect. Flip a switch and a light goes on. As a disruptor, you are dealing with time delays. Huge effort now may yield little in the near term. High output in the future may be the consequence of prior action. But there are milestones that we can watch for. For those of you familiar with the traditional S-curve, we learned from that math that whether you're building a business or learning to play tennis, initially, progress will be quite slow, which helps us keep discouragement at bay. Then as you practice, remember the 10,000-hour rule? As you practice, you'll accelerate into competence. And then once you approach mastery, you'll begin to feel less those feel-good effects of learning, and boredom may kick in. As our learning curve crests, if we don't jump to a new curve, we may actually precipitate our own decline. Not necessarily a financial downfall, but our emotional well-being may take a hit. Saul Kaplan said, "My life has been about searching for the steep learning curve because that's where I do my best work. And when I do my best work, money and stature have always followed." In other words, forget the plateau of profits, seek and scale a learning curve. This requires, as you're letting your strategy emerge and you're seeking and scaling this learning curve, that you apply different metrics. How many of you are familiar with Moneyball? Okay, good. All right, for those of you unfamiliar with Moneyball, it is an account by the brilliant Michael Lewis, who also wrote The Blind Side, of how the Oakland A's, one of the poorest teams in Major League Baseball, became one of the most successful because Billy Bean, the general manager, was willing to recast how he thought about performance. Chad Bradford, for instance, when the A's acquired him, he had a relatively slow fastball of 81 to 85 miles per hour, and he looked funny when he pitched, so the scouts overlooked him. Bean's foremost concern was assembling a winning team on a budget, so he was willing to overlook these conventional metrics. Bradford gave up hits like any other pitcher, but his ground ball to fly ratio was 5 to 1 versus the average of 1.1 to 1. Well, ground balls don't go over the fences. They make singles, rarely doubles. Liz Brown used to be a partner at a Boston-based law firm. Now she's the executive director of Golden Seeds, an angel investing network, and a professor at Bentley University. As a lawyer, we all know what the metric is, billable hours. At Golden Seeds, her metric of success is the number of new angels and especially women, because only 12% of angel investors are women. As a professor, the metric is that semester-long transformation from ugh into wow as students begin to learn how pervasive and powerful the law is. When you are disrupting yourself, if the conventional metrics don't apply, be your own Billy Bean and find the metrics that measure you. Now, I'm not going to lie to you. Disruption is sometimes scary and lonely. There were times after I'd left Merrill Lynch as an analyst, and I felt this tremendous loss of identity. I could no longer call people on the phone and say, "Hi, this is Whitney Johnson from Merrill Lynch." It was, "This is Whitney Johnson." And sometimes that didn't feel like quite enough. There were also days when I felt like I was on this thrill ride to zero cash flow. I know, you're thinking. Well, maybe you're not thinking, but I would be thinking. If it's scary and lonely and unpredictable and I have to part with my current standing and maybe swim against the tide, why would I disrupt myself? Because you know, some of you know in here, that in the deepest part of yourself, you must, or you'll die inside a little. Hence what we call the innovator's dilemma. Whether you innovate or not, you risk downward mobility. But there is also a business case for disrupting yourself. According to the research, the odds of success are 6 times higher and the revenue opportunity 20 times greater when you pursue a disruptive course. And I'll let you in on a secret that's not well enough known. Women are great disruptors. In conducting research, trying to understand why women were able to more successfully change jobs than men, the research indicated that women build networks outside of their organization that remain intact when they leave. Not because they set out to, but because they were marginalized, left out of the internal power structure, so they built external networks out of necessity. In other words, women have learned to play where no one is playing or no one wants to play. If you want to unleash a disruptive edge, hire a woman. Even better, invest in and start a woman-led company. According to a Dow Jones study, successful VC-backed companies have 2 times more women in their highest ranks. Indeed, these companies are more likely to go public, to turn a profit, or be sold for more money than they raised. With a nod to Margaret Thatcher, if you want to disrupt, go ask a woman. To conclude, I'd like to share a poem by Mary Oliver. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds. And there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. We spend a lot of time talking about building and buying disruptive companies. Well, we should. But the fundamental unit of disruption is ultimately the individual. We must innovate on the inside. If you really want to move you, your business, and the world forward, dare, dream, do, and disrupt yourself. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks so much to Whitney. And I just want to remind everybody that Whitney will be doing a book signing of her books in Exhibit Hall 1 and 2 from 11 to 11:30. So I want to invite you all to come there. I hope that you all take advantage of all the activities here. The exhibit hall is incredible. I got to pull in a plug for the Health and Wellness Pavilion. Some of you may have noticed this cool bracelet I have. If you go to the United Healthcare booth, you can get some really cool pictures made, and you can get one of these cool bracelets. And this is a Heart Hero bracelet. And we ask you to wear this bracelet to remind yourself to be a hero to your own heart, to eat better, exercise more, and tap into your inner strength. And I can't think of a better start to that than Whitney's comments. So thank you so much, Whitney.
I'll take questions if anybody has any. Okay, really? Am I going to have to do this? All right. Okay, here we go. Yes. Oh, there's a microphone right next to you. Otherwise, people can't hear you.
So my question is, when you're lonely, what do you do?
Well, I
In
usually...
In those lonely plateaus.
Pardon me?
In the lonely plateaus.
Yes. Okay, well, I usually cry a little. Because I think crying is actually, I mean, we joke around, but there's something very cathartic about feeling what you're feeling, and I think it's important because that feeling is actually what can propel you forward in the future. The second thing I do is I make sure that I have, I talk to some of my close friends, and then I like to write. When I write, I can work through things and figure out what's happening and make meaning of what's happening in this experience. Because when you're in that plateau, typically some really important things are going on inside of us, but we can't quite see them. And so I try to write and make meaning of that so that I can go back and reflect on it in the future. Yes.
You spoke a fair amount about meeting other women who had dreams or had lost sight of their dreams, and that led you to creating your blog. And I wondered if you could share some of the strategies that you have developed to help people find their dreams or, you know, rediscover their passions.
Great question. Yes. So I've got this... the first thing, as I mentioned earlier, is that I try to persuade women that actually it's their privilege to dream. And so I've put together, you know, these four bullet points of, you know, we need to dream in order to make meaning of our life, as to your prior question. We need to dream so that we can actually really grow up, because when you dream, you make choices, and learning to make good choices, I know that sounds very sort of pedestrian and almost pedantic, but it is an important part of growing up. And then we also dream in order for our children to dream. They need to see us dream for ourselves so that they know how to dream. And the second part of it is that I really look at is how do you figure out what your dream is? I focus on figuring out what are your innate strengths. Your innate strengths are typically something that you do so reflexively well that when people say, wow, you're so good at that, you actually ignore them because you just think, oh, that's ridiculous. It's just so easy. Why are they even complimenting me? That's actually probably one of your innate talents. I have them look at their acquired competencies. Things like, if you've gotten up at 6 a.m. every morning for the last 30 years, that's an acquired competency, and you can build on that. I also have them look at their feminine strengths. Our society puts so much value on masculine strengths, which are vital, the ability to wield power and to lead, but feminine strengths are also really important, that ability to nurture and connect. And it's likely that in our figuring out our dream, we will build on that in some form or fashion. And then the fourth thing I ask people to look at is, what are your deeply held beliefs? Because we can only dream within the context of our deeply held beliefs. And you may be thinking, well, I don't know what my deeply held beliefs are. I'm not necessarily religious. Well, you can know what they are. Just sit down and think about, what are the 10 quotes that you find yourself repeating over and over and over again, going back to over and again? So one of my favorite quotes is, you can bet your life and that... It's actually a lyric of a song. You can bet your life and that, and twice its double, that God knew exactly where he wanted you to be placed. It's a lyric from a Stevie Wonder song, for those of you who were around in the 70s, Songs in the Key of Life. The reason I love that quote is it tells me, it reminds me that I believe that my life has a purpose. I believe there's something I'm supposed to accomplish while I am here. I believe that God knows me. And so I dream within that context. And so for you, you can understand that whatever your beliefs are, you're going to dream within that context as well. So those are the four things that I really have people look at. And sometimes I invite people to guest blog on my blog, because as you write out what you're puzzling through, that actually helps you figure out what your dreams are. And then the last thing I would say, see, now you've opened the floodgates, is that sometimes we think our dreams are over the rainbow, but they're actually right under our feet. So all this accumulated life experience that you have is actually bringing you to this moment of dreaming. And so don't eschew those things that are sort of right there in front of you. Okay, you.
Hi, I'm a person that decided to disrupt myself a couple months ago.
Yay.
I'm also a person with a horrible patience level, so I'm struggling with that. So do you have any advice for those of us around how to deal with the fact that it doesn't necessarily happen on the schedule you might have been accustomed to?
I have a patience problem too. Yes, I do. So So when you disrupt yourself, you have this idea of something. Where did you go? I can't see. Raise your hand. Okay, so I can talk to you. Okay. So when you disrupt yourself, you have this idea oftentimes of something that you want to accomplish. But remember how I told you, like, when I first left, I thought I was going to produce a reality TV show and publish a children's book, and they didn't work. And so you have this long-range goal of something that you want to achieve. But remember, it's discovery-driven. And so as you're doing all these smaller things that may work or may not work, recognize that that's actually part of the process. It's part of discovering your way to your next dream. The other thing I would say is, if there are two or three big things that you want to accomplish, write them down, put them on a paper, and then try to focus on some other things. It's like when you plant a garden, you can't water it all the time and say, where's the flower, where's the flower? You have to water it every day, and then eventually the flower comes up. So in other words, put down what you want to do, then go distract yourself by doing other things that will help you move in that direction. And at the same time, trust this discovery-driven process, because it will take you where you're supposed to go. Okay, yes.
Whitney, can you please talk about the feminine qualities or strengths that you used in your meetings with the world's wealthiest man?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, one thing is, actually, this is Okay. So before I moved to equity research, I was in investment banking. And for those of you having been in investment banking or that kind of thing, it's a very clubby environment. You're trying to get these corporations to do a deal with you. And so there's kind of this fraternal, let's go out, let's smoke cigars, let's drink together, that they'll want to do a deal with you. And so that did not play to my feminine strengths, because I couldn't go out and be a guy, especially because I don't actually even drink. As an equity research analyst, it's very different, because now I was covering their company. So what I wrote on their company, if I upgraded it, the value could go up. If I downgraded it, the value could go down. And so now we went from this clubby fraternal, let's go hang out together, to sort of this tango, if you will, of they wanted me, the courting dance, if you think about it, they wanted me to think well of their company and favorably. So that's kind of on a meta level. I think on a more basic level, I think that I was able to, women tend to be really good listeners, and so I would ask questions, and I would listen. I would ask to do things, like one time we went to a meeting, and I took a group of investors, and we went into his office, and he showed us this list of his favorite books, and I asked to do something like that, and I think that was that connectedness, that relatedness, that oftentimes it wouldn't occur to a man. It would be something that he would learn, but it wouldn't come naturally, and that was able to develop and strengthen the relationship. Yes?
Hi, you talked a lot about disrupting yourself and changing roles. For those of us who are part of a large corporation and in role and wish to be disruptive from inside that role to facilitate change, the problem that we deal with is the conflict that arises because others around us don't want to do something different. And so can you talk about tools we can use to deal with the conflict, remaining in role, but being disruptive?
Yes, I can. So the first thing I will say is that, number one, sometimes you can't. So I need to put that on the table. Sometimes you're going to want to do something different. So when I was at Merrill, I wanted to move up into management. And they said, we really love right where you are. We don't ever want you to leave. That's going to happen. So it may be the possibility that you do need to leave. But if that is not the case, I think there are a couple of things you can do. Number one is that for women in particular, it's really important to manage not only up, but sideways. And if you're disrupting, and people are sort of familiar enough with this parlance, they know that as an incumbent, they need to be threatened. And so you have to work sort of double and triple time to socialize the idea that you are going to do something else and help them understand, like, over and over again why you're jumping to a new curve is a win for them. It's not easy. The other thing I would do is I would get a coach. We talk about having coaches as swimmers or tennis players or athletes. And I, if I could give myself one piece of advice when I first got into the workplace, it would have been to get a professional coach to help me think through and strategize. I know all the coaches in here are so happy that I just said that. To help me think through and strategize, how do I do this? I know I want to disrupt myself, but I need another sort of set of ears that's outside of the organization that kind of help me figure this out, because it is a negotiation every day, and it is... And it's a negotiation to help them see the win-win. And I personally, for me, that's pretty complicated for me to do on my own when there's so much emotion around it for me. Right, I think, oh, okay, come. And I don't know how we are on time, so when it's time, just, you know, shut us down. Okay, please.
Hi, can you hear me?
Hi, talk a little louder.
Okay, now?
Yes.
You're talking about feminine and masculine traits that you should exhibit or
right.
can or have the right to exhibit. What if you're disrupting yourself from a cultural aspect? And I'm speaking on my own personal cultural aspect.
Yeah.
You come from a culture where you don't do certain things as a woman. So do you work at disrupting yourself from different layers, or do you just go full force all out? I mean...
Well, you can go full force all out, and there will be times when you will, mm-hmm. But it's like a bull in the china shop. And if you think, okay, so let me back up. This masculine and feminine, where this comes from is Jungian psychology, that in order to be a whole person, we each have a masculine and a feminine part of our psyche, and that the masculine is to wield power, the feminine is the relatedness and nurturing. And to be a whole person, whether a man or a woman, we need to learn to be both the ship, the masculine, and the harbor. So if you're trying to disrupt yourself culturally, one of the important pieces is to maintain the relationships of people that you care about. Now, you're not always going to be able to do that, but as you're asserting yourself, you're going to try to do that within. And I'll give you actually a really good example, and I can't believe I'm about to say this, but I am Mormon. And Mormon women don't always work. But I do work. And so for me, that's been a very interesting sort of navigating. And I actually wrote a piece, an op-ed, about Romney and sort of him being needing to get in touch with his feminine side, because I don't think he does it very well. So, but I say it very politely, very gently. I don't say it stridently. At least I don't think I do. And so what I would say to you is, yes, you want to disrupt yourself, but because you have relationships that you care about, you want to do whatever you can to sort of just gently move along. And it actually goes back to her question a moment ago, is that it's a matter of getting other people comfortable with your change. And I'll give you an example. What Not to Wear, did you ever watch that show with Stacey London? We love that show, right? But do you ever wonder what happens to the woman after she goes home? She's had this fantastic makeover. She's way hotter than her husband. What does she do? Really? Right. I wonder, do they stay together? So, but she loves him, and so, but she has to make him feel comfortable and make sure that he knows that she still loves him. So that was a long-winded answer, but what I'm saying to you is you need to listen to your own voice, but part of finding who you are is also attending to your relationships. It's a fine line to walk, but you can do it.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Yes.
Do you think the process changes at all if you are the sole breadwinner, or you're the like I'm a single mom, and so I want to disrupt and I go in the process, but it moves slower because I have to protect.
Yes,
certain
I think
things.
I would say two things to that, Jeannie. The first is, number one, is that oftentimes we think that we're not disrupting ourselves from a career standpoint because it's about money, and I'm not saying in this instance it mm-hmm. isn't, but I did have one gentleman say to me, I have 10 years worth of savings in the bank, and yet I'm still not willing to disrupt myself. So there's something else going on. So when we're not willing to disrupt and we think it's money, we need to just make sure that's not what it is. I'm actually the breadwinner as well. So what I would say is that when we have to keep food on the table, what it means is that you probably need to keep doing what you're doing, put food on the table, but this other thing that you want to do, you need to start it. Now, what's the guarantee that you're actually going to start it and follow through and it doesn't get crowded out and off to the periphery? Well, you need to find customers for that other thing. What do I mean when I say customers? Well, it could be people that are paying you to do it. But it also could be what it was for me in the instance of starting to blog. You know, once I had 25 people actually reading my blog, then I had customers because they were counting on me to deliver it. So when I say customers, meaning people to whom you are accountable to deliver something. And so my advice to you is stay the course, keep putting food on your table, socking away money or whatever it is that you need to do. But then what this other thing you want to do, find a way that there's an accountability so that you have to keep pursuing it.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome. Okay, all right. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure having you.